Hi, and welcome to Bloody Good Reads. I'm your host, Mark Goddard, and welcome to our first proper recording of 2021. We've got some great guests coming up, but my first guest of the year is a huge legend in the horror writing business, and a gentleman I've met once before, and I believe is one of the nicest people I've met on a book signing that I've done in my time at Waterstones. He is the author of The Amazing Manitou, Jin, and the brand new book, which I have in my hand, which I'm bloody well enjoying, which is The Children God Forgot. It is the amazing Graham Arston. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Mark. It's yes, I remember meeting you at Waterstones. Those were the days when we could breathe over people.
when you have so many people in one space.
Absolutely. But I'm very much looking forward to getting back to those days when... we could all the horror authors can all mingle together like we used to. But yeah, thank you. Thank you for your welcome. And it's really great to be able to talk about the new book, The Children That God Forgot, and anything else that you want to talk about.
Well, basically here at Bloody Good Reads, it's quite a laid-back podcast. We just have a general chat about the genre and yourself and your career, which is a lot to talk about. You've been around for a long time. I'm surprised you still get to stay so fresh with your writing, but you do. So, somebody's written for so long and so many different genres as well. So it's going to be very interesting to see your thoughts and your takes on how the genre's changed and how your work's changed over the years.
I think one of the most important things that ever happened to me was getting expelled from school. I'd always been interested in writing. I used to write my own books when I was quite young, when I was sort of 7 or 8 years old. My parents took me to see 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea with the movie with Kirk Douglas fighting a giant squid. And I was so impressed that I rushed home and I wrote my own book in a school exercise book about a harpoonist called Hans Lee who fought with a giant squid. And I put a cardboard cover on it and did a drawing on the cover. And I sold that book to my best friend for a penny. That was my first royalty ever. But but after that, I continued to write books. And I used to go to Croydon Library when I was quite young, 8 or 9 years old. And there was a very motherly woman there. And I said to her that I liked scary books. And she said, we've got... Quite a lot of scary books in the storeroom. And she introduced me to some more books by Jules Verne. Jules Verne had written many more books that never appeared on the shelves that were quite scary. One of them about people going down a mine and being frightened to death. But then she gave me a copy of Edgar Allan Poe's Tales of Mystery and Imagination. Mm. And, of course, that launched me immediately into writing horror stories. Short horror stories. I used to write these short horror stories and read them to my friends at school during break time. We used to walk around the quad, and I would read them these stories, and that was really how I started writing horror.
Well, it's nice that you get to start quite young as well. So getting kind of into the genre quite young. I did when I kind of first dug into horror.
How old were you when you first got into horror, do you think?
See, with me, I read a lot of Goosebumps when I was younger. So for me, okay. It was more, there's a few like Goosebumps shows and that kind of thing. So I got into it, must have been around kind of 7, 8 when I kind of started getting into that kind of fiction. And I've always loved it. Point horror as well was one of the kind of areas that kind of in my teens got me more into like the slasher movie genres as well, strangely.
Yes, I wrote a couple of books for Point Horror actually.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant.
House of Bones was probably the best one. And then I wrote another one called Hair Raiser, which was about the ghastly things that happen when hairdressers leave piles of hair in their basement.
I mean, porn horror is definitely a great way of getting people into horror as well, kind of my area.
What really happened to me was that I was at a boys' school. I was at Whitgift School in Croydon. It was just a boys' school. But my parents moved down south. And I had to move to a mixed school for my sixth form. But, of course, suddenly I found myself with girls. Obviously, girls were a great deal more interesting than Shakespeare or Byron. And after two terms, the headmaster came up to me and he said, you know, you're spending no time at all studying your English A-levels. You're spending all of your time with Jane and with Charmian and with Valerie. And I think, you, which I was, and I think it'd be a good idea if you left. So I was expelled.
Oh, that's an interesting way of getting expelled, though.
After two terms, 16 years old, and I was thrown out of school. And I got a job then at Gerard's, the greengrocers. And I'm still actually very good at twisting a bag of potatoes, you know, twirling a bag of potatoes. I can still do that. Quite expert at that. But suddenly the local youth employment office got in touch and they said, there's a job going on the local newspaper, the Crawley Observer. Okay. So I went for an interview there and they took me on. And that was it. That was brilliant. Training you used to get in those days on a local paper was brilliant because all of the editors and the senior reporters there were sort of retired Fleet Street men and they really knew their stuff. And they taught me how to write a story so it went wham from the first sentence, how to be clear, how to write a story really well. And most importantly, I learned how to interview people. And how to find out what people really wanted in their lives. It really started when, on the first day, actually, I was sent out on my bicycle, to interview a woman whose husband had won a cycling trophy. And I cycled out to her house and knocked on the door, and this little boy answered, and he said, oh, mummy, there's a man at the door. You know, here I was 17. I thought, oh, you know, great. And I went in and I talked to her. Her husband wasn't there, but she told me about his cycling trophy. But just as I was about to leave, she said, he beats me. And I said, what? I said, do you want to talk about it? So we went back into the sitting room and she spent a long time, almost an hour, telling me how her husband abused her, how he beat her, how he, every time she cooked anything that he didn't like, he just threw it against the wall. And she'd been to her sister and told her about it. She'd been to her parents and told them about it. But they just said, well, it's your fault for marrying him. Well, I said to her, well, why don't you go and see your doctor? That might be a start. But there was nothing else I could do. But as I cycled away that day, it was like a Damascene moment. It was like, you know, Saul on the road from Damascus. I suddenly realized that I could talk to people about the most intimate and personal things in their lives. You know, as a sympathetic stranger, I could find out from people that everything that the way they thought, the problems they had, how they dealt with them. And that was really the beginning of finding out how to write about people and what people really wanted to read about. That was that day really made a difference.
Because it's everybody's got a story to tell, and yeah, I mean, I suppose I can't even imagine how it feels to be just going up to talk about something so kind of jovial to end up then having to be placed just being, I don't know how to really explain that.
the whole thing went on because after I did about 4 years training on the newspaper, I tried to get a job in Fleet Street, you know, as a newspaper reporter. Mm-hmm. And I went to the Daily Telegraph, and the chap said, "You're jolly good, you know, you're quite good, you know, but why don't you go up north to say." A Manchester Evening News for a while and get a bit more experience. And I thought, up north? Are you mad? I'm not going up north, you know. And then I went to see my uncle, who actually was the property editor of the Evening Standard. And I bought him a beer. And I said, Uncle Bill, how about a job on the Evening Standard? And he said, yeah, it's quite good. You need a bit more experience. Why don't you go up to the, you know, Liverpool Evening Telegraph or something like that for a bit? And I thought, I've got very different. I'm not going up north. I'm not doing it. I'm really not, you know, because those are the mod days, you know, and I was down in London going to all the clubs and stuff like that. But then a girlfriend of mine said that she'd seen somebody on the tube reading a new magazine called Mayfair, which was a kind of rival to Penthouse and Playboy. So I bought a copy of Mayfair, as you do, and I wrote a letter to the editor of Mayfair saying that I was the most brilliant reporter that ever was, and I'd be absolutely amazing on their, you know, working for their start. It was, and they gave me an interview, and I went up and I met the publisher of Mayfair in a very tiny office in just off Fleet Street, and he said, "Come and have an interview." We went to the RAC Club in Pall Mall, and we went for a swim in the swimming pool. I had an interview having a swim, you know. You know, he asked me, you know, everything about my career and what I'd done and stuff like that. And I told him I'd written a lot of features for the local paper and stuff. And he said, "Oh, yeah, we'll give you a job." So I became the deputy editor of Mayfair, which I didn't realise at the time that there was the publisher, the editor, me, the deputy editor, a secretary, and the publisher's dog, and that was the entire staff.
Jesus.
Well, everything else, like the photographs, you know, and most of the design was all done by outside freelancers. I did practically everything.
Jeez, that's a good way of starting off, though.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I was 21. I even had to write the reader's letters because we didn't get a Penthouse did very well with reader's letters. They seemed to get a lot of reader's letters about various perversions, but we didn't get any, so I had to write them all. But
is that how you kind of maybe started getting into, because you did a lot of sex instruction guides?
Oh, absolutely.
Is that kind of how you got into doing that?
Yes, I did. Well, partly those. I mean, in those days, the sexiest letter you would write was, "Oh, I was going upstairs in a bus, and this girl was wearing a miniskirt, and I could see her knickers." You know? That was about the most erotic thing that you could write. But one of the other things I had to do was go to the studios, the photographer studios, and talk to the girls who were going to be the Mayfair Girl of the Month. So there I was talking to these girls with no clothes on and saying, you know, why did you, trying to get some text to go with the pictures, saying to them, you know, why did you want to appear in the magazine? You know, was it the money, or was it, you know, or do you just think you're pretty? Or, my boyfriend thinks I'm lovely, and he says he thinks I ought to be in a magazine. And but then I would start talking to them about their personal lives and their sex lives. And while all the other men who came into the studio would just goggle at their breasts, I would spend a lot of time talking to them about, you know, the relationships they were having, whether they were happy, and how things were going for them in their sex lives. And they would tell me, you know, just like the, you know, the woman who told me that her husband beat her, they would come out with everything. You only have to ask and they'd tell you. I learned so much from that. And in the end, I went to the publisher of Mayfair and I said, "Listen, we could do a really good monthly article that is based on sort of anecdotal, the stories of these girls and the sort of sex lives they're having." So I started a monthly feature called Quest, it was. And it was sort of question and answer, you know, sex advice column based on what these girls had told me. And it was very successful. Then I had a big row with the editor of Mayfair. It was really stupid row, but I'd been there quite a long time, and I quit. I walked out. I said, you know, I'm not putting up with this anymore. I thought he was a nice guy, but he was a bit stuffy. And I got in the phone box. I rang up the editor of Penthouse, and they gave me a job at the end of the week. So I then became deputy editor. I then became deputy editor of Penthouse, and. I know, terrible. What a terrible. You can't imagine the stress. What a terrible thing to be on a deputy editor of Penthouse. But the good thing about that was that Penthouse then was just starting up in America. It's originated in England, and but they just launched in America, and so they flew me over to America to help with the development of Penthouse in America. And when I was there, I met Howard Kaminsky, who was the editor of Warner Paperback Library, as it then was called. Howard Kaminsky is a great guy. In fact, he's actually the cousin of Mel Brooks, whose real name is Mel Kaminsky. Just give me a bit of irrelevant information. But Howard said to me, you know, Graham, he said, why don't you write a sex book, you know, like stuff you used to write before? So he commissioned me to write How a Woman Loves to Be Loved. But we didn't want to do it under my own name, so we did it under the name of Angel Smith. And there was a picture of Angel on the cover in a wet T-shirt. And it's a book, tremendous seller. It was one of the first really just anecdotal sex books, just describing sex, you know, conversationally rather than medically, like most of the books. Mm-hmm. Apart from The Joy of Sex, it was one of the first really just anecdotal sex books. Cool. And it sold really, really well, and I wrote another one. But then Angel started getting fan mail, a lot of fan mail. And my wife and I were in bed one morning. We got a Jiffy bag, and in it was a letter saying, Dear Angel, I adore you. I would love to meet you, and I'm enclosing a present for you. And inside the Jiffy bag was a condom. And the writer said, I have rolled this off on myself and rolled it off again as a present for you. If there is a Guinness if there's a Guinness World Record for the speed that a condom can be flung across a bedroom, I have that record. And after that, I said, I don't want to be Angel anymore. I'm going to be me, and that's why. So that's where I started writing sex books under my own name. Mm-hmm. But again, very successfully, I wrote 29 altogether. The first one was How to Drive Your Man Wild in Bed, which is enormously, so really sold millions of copies. Really did really well. But after maybe 3 or 4 years, after I was living, I'd left Penthouse and I was living comfortably off these sex books. My publisher, and I had a different publisher then, Pinnacle Books, and they got in touch and they said, unfortunately, the market has been flooded with this type of book now. We don't want any more. Mm. But I had written for my own amusement, The Manitou, this horror novel about a Native American spirit who returns from the dead to get his revenge on the Paleface. It was based partly on the Buffalo Bill Annual of 1955, which I'd read when I was about 10 years old, and on the first pregnancy of my wife, Vishka. So I sent them. It's only taken me about 5 days to write. But the whole point about it is, and I think the most, and this is what a lot of writers of horror fiction really need to get their heads around, is that it was about nothing that anybody in the horror market had ever written about before. Mm. It was about the Manitou, a Native American spirit. And it sold about 500,000 copies in 6 months. And it was just so unusual. And I got tremendous response from the Native American community as well. Mm. Sitting Bull's granddaughter took us for lunch at the in New York, and presented me with a framed portrait of her grandfather, Sitting Bull.
Bloody hell.
She actually took us to the Russian Tea Rooms, which I don't know how appropriate that was, but it's a very, very fancy restaurant in New York. Mm. So after that, I stopped writing sex books and started to write horror books. I wrote The Revenge of the Manitou and The Djinn and Tengu and all sorts of, and then also branched out into writing other books like historical sagas and political thrillers and things like that.
You know, it's a great place to really kind of segue into asking what your first bloody good read is.
Well, my first bloody good read actually has to be Edgar Allan Poe's Tales of Mystery and Imagination. I have a friend, a writer friend, Dawn Harris, or Dawn G. Harris, as she calls herself, and she gave me a really old copy of the Tales of Mystery and Imagination. But that was the book that really started me off being able to write horror and writing very original horror, because I don't write about zombies or werewolves or vampires. I mean, vampires, really. A vampire comes and bites a young woman's neck. How does a grown vampire get enough sustenance out of a young woman's carotid artery? Why doesn't he make a terrible mess on her pillow? You know, it just doesn't work. You know,
yeah,
it's all right. I mean, Dracula is quite a good book and quite scary and of course very original at the time. But I absolutely avoid vampires. I've wrote one vampire book. Just to sort of put the record straight, I wrote a vampire book called Descendant, which was about the Strigoi, the actual original Transylvanian vampires. But this really stuck close to the original Romanian legends. These vampires, they don't just give you two little holes in your neck so that you walk around the next day saying, "Oh dear, I seem to have a puncture in my neck." you know, these vampires rip you open and absolutely take your heart out and drink your blood in gallons.
Which is how it should be.
which is, you know, that's what they want. And I don't write about werewolves or zombies, you know. It's just been done so many times before. And there are so many. And this is the whole thing about Edgar Allan Poe. All his stuff is very original and unusual. You know, like all the dwarves he has setting fire to themselves and the fall of the House of Usher and people bricking themselves up in walls. Really, really original, unusual stuff. And written with sort of enormous conviction. And which is what I've always tried, obviously in more modern language than he used. But that's why it's one of my favourite books, because he's completely unusual and original. And I think that's what horror writers really should be. I see so many books again and again and again. Oh, it's the zombies again. It's the ghosts again. Mm-hmm. My publisher's head of Zeus asked me about a year ago, could I write a haunted house story? I said, oh, come on, do me a favour. You know, how many haunted house how many haunted house novels are there in the world? But in the end, I gave in. I said, all right, but I did write a haunted house story, but it didn't have ghosts in it. If you read The House of 100 Whispers, which came out last October, which is my haunted house story, but it's not really anything like the normal ghost story. You know, there are so many. You look around the world and how many mythologies there are, and how many demons and devils and interesting creatures there are in ethnic mythology that you can use. I've had Tengu, which is a Japanese demon. I've had Lyaks, which are Balinese demons. They're all fascinating. They're frightening. They make great stories. And I think, right like Edgar Allan Poe and his Tales of Mystery and Imagination, he was the one who really put me on the course of writing novels about events that nobody else had ever thought about.
I mean, do you do a lot of do a lot of research while, because obviously, you know, you must do like Tengu. Not a lot of people would then maybe go and research that before they start writing a horror novel. But you've gone out and you've kind of looked at all these different mythologies. Is it something that you like to do while kind of thinking?
Yes, important. I mean, I'm writing a book at the moment, which is about a Pakistani demon, basically. And the research is enormous, but very interesting. And of course, the more believable it is, the more frightening it is. If you can make a, I mean, I research everything. I research right down to the streets where people live, and absolutely down to every single detail. But the mythologies, some of them are really scary, because that was how people used to explain the dread they had in their lives of things like, well, maybe like a pandemic, like COVID-19. People would explain that by saying it was a devil that was coming amongst them. That's how they used to explain things. And cop death and cattle death and things like that, they'd all be explained by demons and devils. And so there's an enormous wealth of mythology which you can draw on for a horror story.
So you had the Manitou. Was you always planning on doing a Harry Erskine series? Or was it kind of just built up over the years? Because you've done quite a few different series over the years.
Yes, because sometimes you create a character like Harry. Harry's probably the character is most like me more than any other character. I've written about Harry Erskine, and I've written about a teacher called Jim Rook, who's got the ability to be able to see supernatural demons and events like that. And I've also written a crime series about detective superintendent Katie Maguire. I've written 11 books in that series. You develop a character, and then you think, well, they could go on, and they've become a full character, and they could do more. The only problem is people keep getting in touch and say, like Harry Erskine from the Manitou, who was this sort of fake sort of charlatan, who finally ends up beating the Native American demon. People keep getting in touch with me and say, "Can we have? What's he doing now?" And I say, "Well, actually, I rang him up." And he said he's in Florida and he's reading fortunes for old ladies, but he doesn't really want to get involved anymore. He's had enough of fighting Native American demons. I would love to write more about them, but there are also new ideas to be developed, and that's what I'm doing. Yeah. New characters. I'm writing new books with new people in them, with new people that I like. The new book that I've just published next on February the 4th, The Children That God Forgot, that's got Detective Superintendent Jamila Patel and Detective Constable Jerry Pardo. And I like those characters. I like developing them, and I hope they appear in more stories. The only trouble is, Mark, honestly, it's the time. You just don't have the time to do it, because a book that takes somebody 3 days, 2 or 3 days to read, take 6 months to write.
Yeah.
And some people seem to think you can just sit down and you're just describing something that really happened, but you're not. You're creating a whole world inside your head, and you have to research everything that goes with it, make it believable. And it's an enormous amount of work that goes into a novel.
Especially if you're doing a series. Like a Katie Maguire series. I spoke to Mark Billingham a few episodes ago, and kind of talking to him about how do you keep your story going with the same character? How do you find kind of keeping the run of what the Katie Maguire character's done over the series of the books? Do you have like a compendium of what she's done, or do you kind of just take it as it goes? How do you write a series like that?
Well, it started off when my late wife and I lived in Cork for a while, for a few years. And that's a mad place, Cork. God, man. Absolutely nuts. A lovely, lovely, lovely city. Absolutely. Mm. In Dublin, they say they speak the best English in the world. You remember, Terry Wogan used to speak that sort of very precise. It's only Cockney stuff like that, and you can understand hardly a word. It took 6 months before we could understand what anybody was talking about. Apart from that, they have a very varied slang, which is quite difficult to keep up with. But I was fascinated by it, so I thought I'd love to write a book set here. And I haven't seen hardly any novels at all that were set in Cork, although it's such a fascinating city with such a long history. And I also wanted to write about the Irish Police Service, the Garda Síochána, and their problems they've been having with sexism and their female officers and stuff like that. So all that came together, and I wrote the first book. But having done that, Casey Maguire came alive. And so I thought, well, I'll just have to write some more. And also, and this is where having been trained as a reporter comes into it. There are news stories happening all the time, news stories. And Casey could actually deal with these news problems. There were drug problems in Cork. There were homeless problems in Cork. And most importantly, there was the problem of the mother and baby homes, which has been a big scandal in Ireland at the moment. And I wrote a novel based on how she dealt with that. So but she became and still is to me a living character. So it wasn't difficult to remember how she developed and how her relationships developed. And these people, like Casey Maguire and like Harry Erskine and like Jim Rook and like these Detective Patel and Pardo, they become, to you, they become real people. And it isn't difficult to remember their past or to look forward to what they're going to do next.
So what is your second bloody good read?
Well, my second book, it's a bit of a bit biased in a way, but it's Diviner, which was the first novel written by my friend Dawn Harris. It's about a young girl who has the Clarissa, who has the ability to when she looks at people and for just a moment, when she looks at them, she can see their personality in their face, rather like some of the paintings that were done by Rubens and people like that. They would actually show somebody's personality in their face. But she can see that if somebody's an evil person or an ugly person, as she goes along, just for a moment, their face can become grotesque, and she can understand that and see it. But at the same time, she is what they call a diviner. It's a hereditary ability to be able to do this. But it goes back. The story goes back to right goes back to classical times when the little spirit, it was very upset by people who could do this diviner, and he's pursuing her. He's like a very nasty cherub who's pursuing her through her life. But it's very, very well written, very much involved in Clarissa's character as a young woman. It's probably a book that I would recommend to sort of young women in their 20s and things like that, because it's a lot to do with the problems that a young woman goes through, but with this supernatural element in it as well. Actually, I sent it to Fred Caruso, the film director, who was the producer of Blue Velvet, amongst other movies, and he absolutely loved it. He said it has such believability, which for a supernatural story is, for me, is one of the most important things. And Dawn did really well with it. So that's my second book. I know she's my friend, but the book is but the book's so good that it's and she and I actually have written a couple of horror stories together. She's actually one of the first writers that I've been able to work with, actually write with. Because most of the time, I find co-authoring a bit difficult. But she and I, our brains sort of click together. We've written two horror stories, one called Stranglehold, which was has been published in America and in Russia and in Poland and in France and all over the place, and Greece. And another one called Cutting the Mustard, which was about a rather nasty librarian who had an interest in young girls, but got his comeuppance in the end. And that's been published in about 6 or 7 countries around the world. But she's doing well with supernatural fiction, and it's nice to be able to sort of share supernatural thoughts with somebody.
Hi guys, it's Mark here from the Snakebite Horrorcast, snakebitehorror.com, and Bloody Good Reads. Really hope you enjoyed the episode today. I'd like to bring your attention to a brand new supporter of the podcast. They are Abominable Books. It's UK's best horror and thriller fiction book subscription service. They bring the world of horror and thrillers to your door every month for two brilliant prices. It's all the magic of a haunted bookshop summoned straight to your door each month. Basically gives you a brand new horror or thriller title, a luxury snack made here in the UK, a mystery secondhand book, possibly haunted book, and you also get one of our featured magazines like Black Static, Ghastlies and Hellbore, bookmarks, drinks, some surprises or two. It's such a great subscription box, and they are an amazing set, guys. So head over to abominablebookclub.cratejoy.com. There's even two different tiers of subscriptions you can go for in here. So head on over to either get a full guts or a bare bones edition of the box. Let us know what you think of the box and give those guys support. Get back to the show.
It's nice to be able to find someone you gel with. Definitely, it's always good to see a good collaboration.
The only time it happened before was with William Burroughs, you know, the American author. And he and I were good friends. We would spend hours talking about writing, particularly how to write in a way that involved readers and made them feel that they're really inside the book. You know, we'd go on and on and on for hours. He would say, "I want to be," he said, "el hombre invisibile. I want to be the invisible man. When you read my book, you don't feel that there's an author there. You feel that you're inside the story. You can feel the wind on the back of your neck. You can hear the boat whistling in the harbour. You can smell, everything. You can, the reader should be there, actually in the story, as though there. And if I can ever achieve that, you know, to me, that's a success. People have said to me, they finished reading a Katie Maguire story and they still felt they were in Ireland, you know. And I said, "Well, was it raining outside? Was it?"
obviously, doing this podcast, I do get to kind of read a little bit more than I used to do back when I used to do book reviews. But reading your new book, it's the first time I've actually wanted to stick reading with it. It is so engrossing, and we. Saying about kind of picturing yourself in a place, there's a scene in your new book in the sewer systems with the build up of the fat deposits and in the sewers and kind of the surprise, which I won't spoil, but there's a surprise kind of pop up in front of them. You feel like you're there, and in a way, in the cheesiest way ever, you can smell bear even though you're not there. You know, it's probably the first book I've actually read for ages, which has actually made me want to keep reading, and I'm a very slow reader in general. So, but no, I like that. It's your writing does kind of keep you in there, which is good.
You sometimes see these things by writers saying that Stephen King, for instance, saying rules of writing. And in fact, I've done a few on my own UK website, some sort of suggestions, but they're only suggestions rather than rules. So many people say, "Oh, you mustn't describe what people are wearing, or you mustn't bother to describe smells or anything like that." But you know, smells is one of the most important things that you know. You walk into a room. What do you do? Your first reaction is you smell something, and to describe that is important. Also, what people are wearing. When I look at people, one of the first things you look at is what they're wearing. That's almost the first way you evaluate. That's your first evaluation of what they are and their background and who they are. Mm. In fact, my old chief reporter on the Crawley Observer, first thing he said to me, look at their shoes. Look at their shoes, and that will give you an idea of how much money they've got, what they think of themselves, how fashionable they are. You can assess somebody almost instantly by their shoes, and then you look at the rest of the clothes. And I don't ever do it. You know, I don't go down to every single bloody button on their waistcoat or anything like that. But at the same time, it's important, I think, for a reader to know how somebody dresses and just what they look like.
And it drags you into the story. And the whole point of it is, in a way, to read a book is to picture it in your mind. It's, you know, like it's like watching a movie in your mind while you're reading. You've got your own image. It's why I kind of sometimes find kind of adaptations can kind of not gel as well, because, you know, I read Red Dragon after watching Silence of the Lambs. So you're always in your head going to picture Anthony Hopkins. But if you read the book first, it's not always going to connect. So the good thing about reading, which I love, is you can picture these characters, and you do have a picture of these characters in your mind. And if it's not described properly, you're not going to get a proper picture of the person.
Absolutely. And there are some odd things you can put in, you know, just completely random side details that bring the thing to life, you know. Yeah, you walk into a hospital room and the guy's sitting there, he's got a half-eaten ham sandwich and an empty packet of salt and vinegar crisps next to his bed. It tells you something about what time of day it is, where you are, what sort of person this is. I just like doing that kind of thing. I mean, I know there are writers who do disapprove of it, and there are some writers who are brilliant at dispensing with almost every detail. There's a few lines in a book by Tolstoy, I can't remember what it is now, where he describes distant mountains, and it's like one sentence. And I read this sentence again. How did he do that? It was so brilliantly written. You could just picture these distant mountains, and yet, you know, he didn't go on about there was snow on them or, you know, there were trees in the distance or anything like that. But you know, that's classy writing. But you know, certainly, I think writing should be very simple. There should never be words in your writing that trip the reader up and suddenly shake them out of their suspension of disbelief. But at the same time, you know, you should try and be unusual and interesting.
So, what is your third bloody good read?
My third book. Well, I'm afraid I don't read very much fiction because I'm very critical. And
we've had some interesting choices over the last year. So we've had some historical, had some self-help, we've had everything on this podcast. So yeah.
Well,
Sean Hudson. I mean, Sean Hudson. We just released his episode, and I think two of his books weren't even horror, but weren't even fiction. Cause he even said, as I said, he doesn't read much fiction anymore. He kind of he likes historical fiction.
Well, if you're a fiction writer, and if you're a critical fiction writer, and if you criticize your own work, it's very difficult to read somebody else's work, you know, and you suddenly think, oh my God, you shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have described it like that. That is really, really bad. I used to read, I used to like Len Dayton a lot years ago before I started writing professionally. But I could always tell with a Len Dayton novel when he got hungry, because he would rush the end of a chapter, and I could think, you know, this chap's hungry. He's just finishing it off, and he wants to go and have something to eat. You could tell it was ridiculous, and I can tell that now. You know, it's sometimes, you know, and there's a clumsy use of words or something like that, and it just makes, for a professional writer, sadly, it makes you despair. You think, oh, I can't read this, because, you know, it's the idea is good and the writing is well intentioned, but it's clumsy. I'm sorry, I would go through this like a tsunami and really sort out the grammar. And grammar is so important. I don't care what anybody says. It's a book called, it's a fantastic, great big fat book by Jerry White, London in the 18th Century, A Great and Monstrous Thing is the subtitle. And it's an account of London in the 18th Century. The reason I bought it and the reason I picked it up is because I was writing two crime books based in the 18th Century. And one's called Scarlet Widow and the other's called The Coven. They've done quite well, actually. I'm hoping that perhaps to write some more. They're very hard work to write. To write about the 18th century is extremely difficult. And this is why Jerry White's book has been so brilliant, because it contains every single detail that you could possibly want to know about London in the 18th century, particularly the extraordinary crime and prostitution that went on there. Like about 1 in 20 women was a prostitute in those days. It was the best way for a woman to make a living. But all kinds of other details, like when you're writing a book set in the 18th century, you have to know what food they ate, where they would go for entertainment, you have to know what clothes they wore, all these kind of detail. And good old Jerry White has produced a fantastically informative book that really helped me to write my books about Scarlet Widow and the Coven, which the Coven is about a sex ring in Covent Garden. But that it's a great book, and I would recommend it. And it's very clearly written. It's really, really good. But as I say, when you write a book about the 18th century, and you ask yourself questions like, did women wear knickers? And the answer is no, they didn't. You know, knickers were only invented. Knickers were invented much later. But you have to know things. You know, if you're writing a book about women in the 18th century, you have to know these sort of things. How does she get dressed in the morning?
And it goes back to the point of research as well. So it's factual, even though, you know, which you can use in your own work, which is great.
Oh, absolutely. And you have to know things like, how do people get around? How much did it cost to get from one place to another? What were the places of entertainment? Where were the Vauxhall Gardens and places like that where people went for fun? What do they drink? What do they eat? And books like that are absolutely invaluable when it comes to writing a novel like that. Because you don't put it all in. It's just mentioned just in passing, but it gives the story a believability that, again, makes it frightening, you know, makes it dramatic, and makes people really think that, you know, they're there.
So your new book, The Children God Forgot, tell us a bit about the new book.
I nearly didn't write it. It was very difficult. Well, it was a very difficult decision to write, because it's fundamentally, it's about abortion. And obviously that's a very difficult subject, because there are pro-lifers who believe that all life is sacred from the moment of conception. And there are those who defending the rights of women when they've become pregnant through rape, or they're facing the situation where they're told that their fetus is, has severe problems and may not live very long, or may, you know, live a very, very difficult life and have a great many problems. So I wanted to write about it, but it's, as I say, it's a very, very difficult subject to write about. But in the end, I thought, well, I'm going to do it anyway. I'll just plunge into it and do it. I didn't even know whether it wasn't commissioned, unusually, because most of my books are commissioned. It wasn't commissioned, but I just wrote it anyway. I sent it first to my British publisher's head of Zeus, and they said yes. They thought, great, you know, it really deals with the subject in a way that's acceptable. And although it's scary and although it's weird, it's still something that they feel that people will be able to engage with. And I sold this in France to my French, actually Belgian publishers, Livre. Emilie Anzio, who's the editor there, she liked it. And I also sold it to Rebus in Poland, where it's published under a name that I just can't pronounce. but today,
I'm part Polish. I know how hard it is.
That's a terrible thing, you know. I'm very popular in Poland, but in fact, my Polish publishers Rebus got in touch with me today to say that The Children That God Forgot has been nominated as one of the best horror books of 2020. And we're just waiting for the voting to take place at the end of the month to find out whether it's the best Polish horror novel of the of 2020. So it's done very well there, despite, of course, the great problems that they're having in Poland, considering the situation of abortion, where it's almost been where the very right wing new government has almost banned it completely. You know, it's had quite a reception there. So it's, you know, it comes out, when it comes out in the UK, we'll just see, have to see how people respond to it. It, as I say, it's a book that it was difficult to write, but then I thought, in the end, I've got to write this. I can't ignore this subject. I've got a view on it, and other people have got views on it. As I say, the pro-lifers and those who feel quite the opposite, and that it's a woman's, in a woman's body, and her right to make the decision of whether an abortion should take place or not. I just hope that people, you know, it will help some people make their own minds up of what they think about it. You know, it's a scary book as well, I hope.
Mm.
Did you find it scary?
I'm loving it. I'm loving it so far. I mean, I'm about halfway through. I'm loving it so far. There's without spoiling too much, it's at the start of the book, but the scene in the hospital when they are going to take the baby out, it's so creepy and well described. It just a little bit of a shiver down the spine with the kind of the fingers on the tentacles, and yeah, it's a brilliant book. I'm absolutely loved it so far. It's been a while since I've actually really sat and enjoyed a book like this properly. Without reviewer eyes on as well, it's actually just as a reader for a change. which is something I don't get to do often.
Well, again, you know, I had to do all the research about cesarean sections and all stuff like that, and I talked to some gynecologists about how despite the fact being weirdly supernatural, it is you know, the medical side is very realistic.
So what are you working on next?
I'm working on a book called The Shadow People. It's based on homeless people, but it goes a little bit further than that. It's another supernatural book, and it's another book that features Detective Superintendent Patel and Detective Constable Pardo. It's about homeless people. It's also got a historical background to it, which I don't think I'm going to reveal at the moment, because it's not terribly historical, not 18th century, but something that affects something that has affected lives these days. I've tried to get both a kind of imaginary threat, but a realistic threat as well, and also dealing with the problems that homeless people have to deal with. So it's a bit of both. I do like to have, you know, realistic contemporary themes in the book, you know, that really bring it to life. And, it should be coming out in December, as far as I know.
I'm looking forward to that one, especially if it's got the same characters in your new book as well. So
I'm looking forward to it as well. I've got to finish it.
Well, I can talk to you for hours. It's been such a lovely chat as well, but I'm going to have to wind up the podcast annoyingly. I really hate it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for listening, and I'm sure it'd be nice to come on again and tell you how things are going.
And a huge thank you to Graham Austin for joining us this week on the podcast. I hope you guys out there have enjoyed listening to this episode. I've really enjoyed chatting to Graham. And I hope you've got some good stories out of this as well. His new book, The Children God Forgot, is available now out in hardback, and I believe possibly in Kindle as well, in the UK. So go and check it out. In the US, check your Amazon listings. I'm sure it's out over there as well. You can catch me over on Instagram at Seb Bloody Good Reads, on Twitter at Bloody Good Reads, and also over on Facebook. If you type in Bloody Reads in the group, come join the group, have a chat with us, and we'd love to have you over there. As always, I've been your host, Mark Goddard, and I'll see you next week.